Good morning. It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today filling in for Kathleen Dunn. Well, coming up this hour, we're going to be taking a look into the future for the next hour with our guest. Joshua Cooper Ramo is the author of the book The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. In addition to being the author of this new book, he is also a managing director at Kissinger Associates, one of the world's leading strategic advisory firms. He also has served as foreign editor and assistant managing editor at Time Magazine, and he was also an international affairs analyst for CNN. And as I say, he is the author of the book that we're going to be talking about this hour. In his book, he says that the new world disorder constantly surprises us because many leaders and leading thinkers think logically. That is to say, he says that they find a relationship between what he calls the power of the state and the physics of change, that there is a direct connection there. But as we'll be discussing during the next hour, the reality of our world is far from that simple, and when the reality isn't seen, it is often changed, at least through traditional means. Well, right now, we happen to be missing our guest, and we hope to have him with us in just a few minutes here. But let me pose a couple of questions for you. Are we really living in the age of the unthinkable? Do traditional forms of corporations, do traditional forms of government really work? Or are we living through a period of change that only a very few people actually get? Call with your questions and comments. We're in our Madison studios today at 800-642-1234. You can also join us by email at talk@wpr.org. That address again is talk@wpr.org. And our guest is with us, Joshua Cooper Ramo. Good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hey, good morning, Gene. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'm glad you think so. Sorry about the mix-up in the time there, and hopefully we didn't catch it too short. But
Not at all. It's just really great to be with you all.
Well, good. I mean, your book does talk about being flexible, so
exactly.
We got that going on. Well, let's talk about the book, and I have to say it was a quick read for me. I didn't have a lot of time to read it, but it went surprisingly fast. And I want to start at the beginning, and specifically, I want to start at the title, why you call it New World Disorder. And I'm not sure whether you wrote that or an editor wrote that for the book, but it's an interesting term. And, you know, you hear New World Order all the time, and you say that just isn't so.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm glad that you found it a quick read. You know, one of the things that I said about when I wrote this book, The Age of the Unthinkable, was really I wanted to write a book that was accessible to anybody, that was kind of designed to explain some of the complexities that are unfolding in the world, but in a way that you know, ordinary people can understand. Because I feel like one of the problems today, to some degree, is the world is very complex, and a lot of times we're not really given the information we need to make decisions for ourselves. And so I really wanted a book that helped do that, that was accessible and easy for people to get their hands around. And some of that comes from my experience when I used to be the foreign editor of Time Magazine, of kind of writing in that way. The world disorder question is a really good question to start with, because it's actually where I started working on the book. You know, I sort of spent the last couple of years traveling around trying to understand what was going on in the international system, and I sort of set out on this journey. And in that journey, I said, let's accept that there's some sort of change going on in the world, that the world is looking different today than it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And if you wanted to understand where that was happening, the best thing to do would be go to spend time with the people who were disrupting the world. So I spent time with Hezbollah. I spent time with the guys who started Google. I spent time with bioengineers and rebellious doctors in Africa and the best spy masters in Israeli intelligence, all to sort of just spend time with people who kind of understand the fundamental disruption that's going on all around us. What's happening in the world today is that we're in the midst of a crisis, and I think everybody understands we're in the midst of a financial crisis, and certainly a financial crisis that fits the title of the book, The Age of the Unthinkable. I mean, this is not unthinkable that the U.S. financial system would collapse in a year or that the U.S. economy would be shedding 600,000 jobs a month, but in my view, that's just a piece of it, actually. It's an expression of a much deeper existential crisis in the international system, which is we've arrived at a world now that's much more complex and where there's a lot more risk than our old ways of thinking about the world ever imagined. And so the book is the story of why that's happened, and then it talks a lot about what it is we can do to make sense of it and live in that world and actually thrive in that world once we understand what's going on.
Yeah, you talk about that level of complexity, sort of the intertwined nature of things. And you mentioned Hezbollah a few minutes ago, and we'll be talking about that later on in the hour. And most people don't think of Hezbollah as having any sort of, management structure or any sort of vision. But you compare them pretty directly with, folks that who work at, like, National Security Council, the Army, IBM, Time Warner, places like that. And those places, those kinds of places, you call out of date and inflexible. And places like Hezbollah, for lack of a better place to point right now, is kind of the new model, except that a lot of the suits at Time Warner, IBM, places like that, don't realize it just yet.
Yeah, I think it's very hard. In the last fall, I went to Beirut and spent some time with a guy who's one of the sort of heads of information technology for Hezbollah. I'll never forget going down to South Beirut to see him. And South Beirut was basically bombed flat by the Israelis in the war of the summer of 2006. And so the first thing you notice when you go back there, particularly if you were there right after the war in 2006, like I was, is the incredible pace of rebuilding. And when you contrast that with, like, New Orleans after Katrina or even the southern part of Manhattan, where we still haven't rebuilt after 9/11, you see that Hezbollah has this ability to kind of snap back, to be very resilient. One of the points I make in the book is during that 2006 war, in fact, Hezbollah fired the same number of missiles at Israel on the last day of the war as they did on the first day of the war, just to prove a point of how ineffective this massive Israeli campaign had been. And so my attitude was, there's no question that Hezbollah is really an evil organization, but would it be possible to just go understand why it is, even though they're evil, they seem to be so effective and so good at surviving? Because, I think they are somehow in tune with the spirit of the age, maybe, in a way that we're not. And, it is one of the lessons of history that, you have from time to time these incredibly tumultuous periods where large institutions of government are unable to adapt, and there's tremendous change and rebels outside the system who change things. And I think that's what we're going through now. And, the thing to remember about revolutionary moments is they don't just destroy the old order. They also create a whole new order, and they create new fortunes and new historical champions. They elevate people from great obscurity into positions of great importance. And so being with Hezbollah, as uncomfortable as it is a chance to get a flavor of how our enemies think. And you end up, being a little bit worried that they may understand some of the new rules of power better than we do.
And at the same time, for those people who are involved in, I guess, what you might think of as traditional seats of power, whether it's traditional forms of government or the traditional form of a corporation, the danger, I guess, from what I gather, is that, they're thinking that they've got a system in place, that they're ready for anything. But in reality, you say, they're sort of missing the whole thing, the whole picture.
Yeah, not only are they missing it, but the most dangerous thing is a lot of the experts that we rely on today. And by the way, this isn't a judgment about Democrats or Republicans. It's just a judgment about people who come up inside the system, are adopting policies which not only fail, but oftentimes they backfire. So, the war on terrorism at the end of the day doesn't get rid of terrorists. It produces more dangerous terrorists. Or this attempt to stop the subprime crisis not only doesn't stop it, but somehow maybe freezes lending in such a way that it causes it to spread throughout the rest of the economy. And so a lot of the problem is that the people that we rely on to predict and explain the world can't do that. I mean, nobody in any position of power predicted 9/11. Nobody predicted the financial crisis that we're in. And I think the reason for that is they're using the wrong models for looking at the world.
And let's talk about sort of the underlying basis for that models. I think at some point you call it the underlying physics of our world, because, I mean, it all seems like it's happening all at once, at least, if you look outside, but it really isn't. I mean, this has been happening over a period of time, and I don't know whether people have just been ignoring it or if it just sort of came to fruition all at once.
Well, I think it was this kind of gradual escalating speed of change and complexity. If you think 100 years ago, the amount of change that you would see in your lifetime was large, but relatively small compared to, if you look at kids today, mm-hmm. The amount of change you see between the time you're 5 and you're 15 now is unbelievable. If you were born in 1990, the internet barely existed, and here we are, 20 years later in a completely different world of cell phones and internet connections and data. And so in any given period of time, the amount of change is accelerating. And the argument that I make in the book is, what is it that has been slowly building and causing this change? It's basically three things. The first is that there are more players than ever before on the world stage today. That means there are more people to begin with, but also more non-governmental organizations. There are more terrorist groups. There are more hedge funds. you can't look at the world just as states anymore, or as, you know, collections of large objects. These small objects matter a lot, whether they're Greenpeace or Hezbollah. The second thing is that the number of choices available to people today has exploded. If you look at a number of choices for listening to the radio, I mean, people are probably listening to this on the radio, and some people may be listening to it on the internet. I mean, the number of choices of different internet sites that are available to you, and that's true in our own lives as well. Each of us today has more choice about what to do with our lives than certainly our parents had and our grandparents had. And the third thing, of course, is that we're all more interconnected than ever. And those three things together really change the underlying dynamics of the world. It means that anybody, anywhere in the world can decide to do something which can disrupt the whole system. And it means that we've got to really rethink how we approach the world. Part of the problem today, to some degree, is that we now face a whole set of risks that we can't get away from, because there are risks that come right out of the things we need to be modern: financial markets, jet airplanes, bioengineering. Those are all things we want in our lives. But at the same time that they, you know, create great opportunity, they also create a tremendous amount of risk. And I think that's the thing that we haven't yet internalized, is that our world inevitably is going to get less and less stable in the future. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is something we've got to accept.
And one of the things you speak to is, I think, what you call the danger of simplicity. And I think part of that is that the people like to have things explained in a manner that they can understand. If you listen to politicians, if you listen to talk shows, everybody's trying to take complex things and make them less so people can understand them.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're arguing that you can't make it more simple, because it isn't.
Right. The minute you do that, it falls apart. You know, one of the people I spent a lot of time with was a guy named Aaron Farkash, who was the most successful head of Israeli military intelligence in the last few decades. And, you know, you can imagine that's a pretty tough job. In fact, of the 13 people who had that job before Farkash, 7 of them were fired before they even finished their full terms in office. You know, Israel's always getting attacked and always getting surprised. And Farkash really taught me how to see the world differently. And he said something to me I'll never forget, which is, he said, you know, you can't look at the world like it's just kind of a frozen object, because it's constantly changing. And not only is it constantly changing, but just the process of observing it, the process of trying to do something in the world, changes the landscape. And so you've got to accept that the world is shifting all the time. And that's exhausting. One of the things I did in the book is I said, there are places on Earth which are kind of microcosms for everything going on in the world today, places where there's a lot of change and where surprise is constant. An example of that would be Silicon Valley, where so much innovation comes out of, in California. And, you know, if you look out there, people can never rest on their laurels as a company. I mean, it's not like Apple introduces a computer and says, okay, we're done now. I mean, they're constantly having to introduce new computers, new operating systems. It's version 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. And that's tiring, but that's a pretty good, you know, indicator of what our world is going to look like in the future, that none of us can ever, you know, if you think the job you have now is a job you're going to have for the rest of your life, obviously that's not going to work, and it's unlikely to work. And so that issue of kind of constant reinvention, exhausting as it is, it's really the only choice we have.
And it is exhausting, and I think that is probably one of the reasons that, people sort of resist the notion, and they like to have what they think is a system that works and then go with it. And,
I mean, I think that's the whole, and that's the thing, you know, in all honesty, one of the things that's so shocking about everything going on today, you know, is all of us look at our bank accounts, our 401k accounts, is, you know, I mean, if there's any system we thought we could trust, it's got to be the banking system or the financial system. I mean, markets are going to have up and downs, but, you know, you never thought it would explode like this.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with the author of a book, the new book, I should say, The Age of the Unthinkable: Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. Joshua Cooper Ramo is with us. We'd like to take your calls as well. We have some open lines for you right now at 800-642-1234. You can also join us by email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. What do you think? Is this the age of the unthinkable? Are things moving an awful lot faster than they were maybe just a few years ago? Or are you one of those folks who is on the leading edge? Do you recognize change? Do you recognize the complexities of the world around us? And are you prepared to deal with it? 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in today for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 21 minutes past 10 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. We are talking this hour with Joshua Cooper Ramo, who is the author of the new book, The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. We'll be getting to your calls in just a few minutes. Don't forget you can email us, too, if you'd like, talk@WPR.org. I'd like to turn back to the book for a second before we take some calls and talk about what you call, or you don't call it, I don't think, but the whole sand pile notion, because I found that very intriguing, because you got this great big pile of sand, you've got a little tiny grain in it, and you don't think that has an impact, but you know what? It really does.
Yeah, one of the points I was trying to make in the book about how sort of unstable the world is that you can never know what's going to trigger a catastrophic event. And it's an example of this would be the subprime mortgage crisis or 9/11, you know, things that in an instant completely can transform a landscape. And the traditional way we thought about the world is that stuff like that shouldn't be possible. You know, most of the people who worry about international affairs tend to think in order to get a big result, you need a big impact. So, you know, the only thing that could really threaten the United States in that way of thinking would have been an attack by a major power. And in fact, as we saw in 9/11, you know, terrorism was a huge threat. And as we've seen subsequently, financial crisis was a huge threat. So one of the things I do in the book is I try to use chaos theory, which is this idea that was developed in physics over the last century to explain highly complex systems, to explain the world, which is, of course, the ultimate highly complex system. And one example I use is from a scientist named Per Back, who came up with this notion of the sand pile when he was trying to describe a complex system. Back wanted to find an easy way to explain the physics of unpredictability. And there was an easy way to explain the physics of predictability, which was like Newtonian mechanics. You know, we all know the famous story of Galileo dropping the balls off the Tower of Pisa. And, you know, no matter how many times you drop those balls, you're always going to have the same result. And so that's a very easy way to explain to people the concept of Newtonian physics and gravity and predictability. Back wanted a similar idea that could explain unpredictability. And so he came with this idea of the sand pile. And the idea of the sand pile is very simple, which is if you and I went out and we said, all right, we're going to make a little pile of sand by dropping grains one after another onto a plate, you know, we would just sort of drop them down and they would, you know, sort themselves up into a little cone. But at some point, the sides of the cone would become so steep that there would be a little avalanche and some sand would fall off. And what Back discovered, and what was subsequently shown in experiments, was you could never really predict when those avalanches were going to happen. It wasn't like when there were, you know, 100,005 grains on this pile, there would be an avalanche. You know, sometimes you could have 200,000 and there would be no avalanche. And the reason for that was that the sand piles themselves were what Back called organized into instability, that they were organized in such a way that you could never predict what was going to happen next. Sometimes you could add 1,000 grains and nothing would happen. Sometimes you would add one grain and you would have an avalanche. And his point was that part of the reason you could never predict it was that the inner workings of a system like that are so complex. If you think of, you know, a couple hundred sand grains all pushing against each other, you could never really map them. And so you always had to be prepared for the idea that avalanches were inevitable, but you could never quite know what was going to trigger them. And that's kind of what our world is like today. It's like a big sand pile. And, you know, the grains that are falling onto the pile are all these new things, whether they're hedge funds or terrorist organizations or non-governmental organizations. They're just making our world more complex every minute. But that also means it's sort of organized into instability, where any small thing, you know, somebody catches the flu in Ethiopia or somebody launches a computer attack from China, has the possibility to disrupt the whole system. And that's particularly true today because we're all connected to each other more than ever by cell phones, by computers, by airplanes, by electricity grids. And while it's great for us to all be connected to each other, the fact is the more connected we are, the less resilient we all are. Because if there's a strike anywhere on the network, it can propagate to everywhere on the network. And in fact, the more efficient the network is, the more at risk we are. And the financial markets would be a very good example of this. They're very, very efficient. And the result is this shock from the subprime crisis has spread all across the network, just like you dropped a giant bowling ball in a swimming pool.
Now, I have to ask, we're going to get to calls in a second here, but, you know, when you started out looking at this topic, where did you start in terms of your philosophy, and how did you arrive, and how long did it take for you, if you had to, arrive at the place where you are now?
Well, it's a good question. You know, for me, this book really began on September 11th. I had actually spent the summer before September 11th working at an AIDS hospice in South Africa. At that time, I was the foreign editor of Time magazine. And I took a sabbatical to work in an AIDS hospice because I just wanted to get a better feeling for what was happening. And I felt always, I think, probably like a lot of us when we look at Africa, that there was something really morally wrong there, that 100 million people were going to die of a disease, HIV/AIDS, which was treatable by medicine that was an eight-hour plane flight away. And it just was very hard for me to understand that. And my first day at work after coming back from my sabbatical was September 11th. And, you know, I remember sitting there on that night, because we were putting out a special issue of Time magazine, looking at the photos that we were going to put in the magazine, and just image after image of the carnage in downtown Manhattan, and thinking to myself, you know, we have a way of looking at the world that is not only intellectually flawed because it can't predict things like this, and it doesn't really tell us what to do about these kind of terrorist attacks, but was also really morally flawed, that our foreign policy was not focused on improving the lives of people around the world as intently as it should be, that you know, my grandchildren would ask me, how is it that 100 million people died during your lifetime of something that, you know, you could treat by medicine that was sitting in rooms 8 hours away? And so I really set out to say, is there a way to develop a mode of interacting in the world for us that's both more intellectually coherent and also more morally decent? And that really was the process of writing this book for me, and then to say, can I do it in such a way that people can sit down in 2 or 3 days or as long as it takes to read it, and at the end of it really understand it in a non-complex way? You know, there's been a lot of success in recent years of books like, you know, Blank or other books, which also happen to be my publisher, of explaining complex things in a way that doesn't make them so simple that they're pointless, but actually invites people into understanding their complexity. And that's what I was trying to accomplish with the book. It, you know, so it started in 2001, and then probably the intense writing of the book took about 2 or 2.5 years.
Let's get out to the phone calls right now, find out what listeners have to say. Greg is with us from Watertown. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for the great conversation. I'd like to tie this into the last show that was talking about what our economy was lacking, but I think this rather permeates most of our culture, and that is our inability to act within constraints and the complexity that this causes. And the two types of constraints that I'm particularly concerned about are the ecological constraints and the ethical constraints. And we seem to have divorced ourselves from any type of responsibility or fair assessment of ecological constraints. And primary on my focus right now is that of thermodynamics and how that enforces this concept of peak oil and the peak phenomenon in general, which is going to apply with just about every resource that we get from our ecological systems, and how we continuously violate those principles and expect to get the same results that we have in the past. Then I'd like to jump to the ethical constraints. I think our economy and much of our culture has abandoned basic human ethics like fairness and honesty, compassion, responsibility, and respect. And if you analyze most of the situations that you do, you can recognize that we're really not being fair about our economic system when we completely disregard some of the liquidation of ecological capital and count that on the positive side of the ledger sheet. Then we're not really being honest about things when we do that, and it's irresponsible. If we were going to be responsible in stewarding our ecological resources and even our cultural resources, we need to assess them in an honest and fair way. And there are systems out there that will do this. One of them that I've studied quite a bit is the natural step, and it sets a very well-defined ecological constraints that are understandable and implementable. Such a common language so that we can all talk about this in an honest and fair way. And then the system also helps us understand ethical constraints and social capital so that we can build these resources as opposed to exploiting them and liquidating them and then counting it on the income side of the ledger.
Greg, thanks for the call. And Joshua Cooper Ramo, couple of concerns there from that caller: ecological, ethical constraints. Those are, of course, important pieces of the puzzle. But in your estimation, is that all that we have to worry about?
It's not all that we have to worry about. But one of the points I make in the book is that for a long time now, we've sort of lived in the world as if we had an unlimited amount of resources, and that was an expression of this kind of mania for engineering and building the world, which I don't think makes sense anymore. One of the points I make in the book is that the traditional approach to looking at economic policy or foreign policy or making political decisions was like you were an engineer trying to build a bridge, and that maybe a better way to think of it is if we were gardeners trying to cultivate a system, trying to cultivate plants where there's all sorts of things you can control and all sorts of things you can't control, and so you've got to constantly adapt depending on what the weather and what the environment allows you to do. And I think that's how we've got to be in the world, too. We've got to be a little more thoughtful about the resources that we're using.
And what about his concern about the ethics? I mean, that certainly plays into that, but is there a lack of ethics right now, or just...
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really important point because, you know, in traditional foreign policy thinking or international affairs thinking, you would say, well, morality doesn't really matter because you can't say who's right or wrong. But the fact is, morality is incredibly important. First of all, many of the most, you know, powerful, influential groups in the day today, whether or not you like them or not, have a very ethical worldview, whether that's Hezbollah or Greenpeace. And by ethical, I don't mean right or wrong. I just mean that they feel that they're really doing something that has a moral foundation. The other thing is that, you know, as we look, one of the points he raised was about kind of economics. And as you look at capitalism, you know, it's pretty clear at this point that unrestrained capitalism is an engine for inequality. You know, the world is much more unequal in some respects because of capitalism, which does have the effect of concentrating wealth in the hands of a few. That's what we've seen happen in the United States very much over the last few years. And that's really not sustainable. It's not sustainable, first of all, politically, because it's impossible to have a few people controlling all the wealth and a lot of people with political power because people won't tolerate that. But secondly, it gets to this ethical question, which is, you know, what is a fair distribution of kind of rights and responsibilities in a system? And I think today where you have a lot of people with a lot of money, and there are a few people with a lot of money, and a lot of people who don't have health care insurance, who can't get access to education, you know, there's something kind of wrong about that.
One of the things that you discuss in your book is you talk with Mikhail Gorbachev at one point and talk about the fall of the Soviet Union. And there you had a case of, you know, sort of a closed system. Everybody thought they were in control. And I hate to use the cliche, too big to fail, but I guess, you know, that seems to be a sort of appropriate for the moment. Talk about that example a little bit, because everybody, I think, has their own idea of what happened with the Soviet Union and why it failed. In your estimation, what have you learned?
Well, one of the things I wanted to take a look at is I felt, you know, didn't understand our current way of thinking the world very clearly. And one of the main ideas you hear when you talk to people who make foreign policy, when you talk to people in the corridors of power, which I do a lot of in preparing this book, is this kind of belief that capitalism and democracy are inevitable. And they always talk about the collapse of the Soviet Union as an example of that. And so I went and really tried to look at what it was that caused the Soviet Union to collapse. Because I think most of us, you know, at a first blush think, well, the USSR collapsed because, you know, there was CNN and Michael Jackson and Dallas TV episodes, and there was this kind of uprising from below. But actually, if you look into the details of the collapse of the USSR, it was much more complicated than that. Some of the best scholarship I found, for instance, suggested that the USSR collapsed not because of some up-from-the-bottom rebellion, which had actually happened before and could have been crushed at any time by the Soviet authorities, and it didn't happen because of an economic slowdown. In fact, the Soviet Union was growing marginally in the 1980s and had faced periods of much more economic turmoil in the 1970s and the 1950s, but it was rather that the elites of the Soviet system decided that they would just encourage the system to collapse because they were corrupt and felt they could make more money and do better once the Soviet Union collapsed. And in fact, if you look at the USSR today, if that had been a real people's revolution, then the people running the country of the former USSR would be people who came up from the street. In fact, they're not. They're people who mostly were right near the top of the old system. People like Vladimir Putin, who wasn't some reactionary guy who came off the streets, but rather was a KGB officer in the old government. Mikhail Gorbachev said something which is, you know, I'll never forget, which is he said, it's a mistake to think that the West won the Cold War. And his point was that the Soviet Union just collapsed. It collapsed because he didn't manage reform well. It collapsed because the system was loaded with people who were corrupt. But it didn't collapse because it's inevitable that the world is going to be capitalist and democratic. And I think it's very important for us to keep that in mind. I think we believe fundamentally in the ideas of a democratic system or a capitalist system to some degree, but we've got to remember that those are values you have to fight for in every generation. And this notion that history had sort of ended and everybody's determined that they're going to have capitalism and democracy is really clearly not true.
And the idea that, you look back in history films, that sort of thing, everybody just sort of says, well, Ronald Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and magically it happened.
Yeah. And again, we're talking about oversimplification.
Yeah.
That's an oversimplification. It just doesn't. That's not how the world works.
Another example you use, which I found very interesting, was the story of the Chinese box in the market. And that was very interesting because, it took a while to get to the point, and so I kept reading and reading and reading, trying to catch up with it.
Yeah.
But let's talk about that Chinese box and a little tiny box with a, I don't know how much it cost to make, a couple bucks, I suppose.
Right.
Can threaten billions of dollars of American weaponry.
So one of the points I wanted to make in the book is that, you know, if I was trying to figure out why it is we feel kind of insecure and anxious today, generally. And I think one of the reasons, as I just said, is that a lot of our ideas about the world that we rely on to be secure, like the fact that, you know, we're never going to have a big war between democracies and fascism again, or socialism, I don't think those are right. I think our intellectual security is much more precarious than we would think. But I also make the point that our physical security is much more precarious. And the reason for that, I give as an example, this Chinese box. And the way to understand it is the following, which is the United States, as many of your listeners will know, when we go to fight a war, relies on having air superiority. It's very important to be able to have planes in the sky anywhere, anytime, to control the land. And that's part of the reason we were so successful in Iraq, is that we can do that very quickly. But the Chinese have developed a system that makes it very difficult for us to have air superiority. One of the things that happens when you fly your airplanes over a country is that they will try to shoot them down with surface-to-air missiles. And so the U.S. has developed a system when somebody turns on their radar on their surface-to-air missile that sees that radar and then blows up the surface-to-air missile site. Well, the Chinese have come up with a system that is very inexpensive and that simulates the signals from 10,000 different surface-to-air missile sites, for example. And so if you're a pilot trying to decide which to attack, you'll see, you know, 10,001, for instance, surface-to-air missile signals on your radar screen, and only one of them will be the real one. So it's a very kind of cheap, inexpensive way to spoof the American systems and undo, essentially, billions of dollars of defense spending with something that's much less expensive. And that's important not because China's a threat. I actually think, you know, to that extent, China's probably not a threat, but rather it represents a real shift in the dynamics of war fighting, which is that the U.S., despite all the money we spend on our military, is ultimately, at the end of the day, not simply going to be able to guarantee its security by having more warships and more fighter planes and more submarines, both because it's easy enough to interrupt those systems, and that box in China is an example of that, but also because it's very hard for us to track the things that are often most dangerous for us. So the point I make in the book is that we've really got to be aware of the fact that our physical security is much more perilous than we might think it is.
And the idea of what you might think of as gunboat diplomacy, you know, 100 years ago, isn't that simple anymore either.
Right. One of the other points I make is that so much of our foreign policy is based on this idea of deterrence. And deterrence is this notion of kind of the my dog is bigger than your dog school of foreign policy, which is if I've got a bigger army, you're not going to attack me. But the problem is many of the threats that we face in the world today can't be deterred. You can't deter terrorists who are happy to die for their cause, because if you kill them, that's what they want. You can't deter a financial panic or bird flu or rising Hindu nationalism in India. So we need a view of the world that is very different and that is sort of abandons to some degree our total reliance on deterrence and instead focuses more on resilience, that accepts that we're going to get hit and instead prepares us so that when it does happen, it doesn't totally destroy our society.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Anna is with us from Traverse City. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I picked up the phone early to call, and since then you have basically taken the words out of my mouth. What I was going to say is that I feel that our ethical evolution has fallen far behind our intellectual evolution and our ability to work with technology. And I think that is at the heart of many of these things, not the least of which is the fact that the ideal of capitalism is not reflected in reality for the very reasons your guest explained. It is human nature to want more, the more you can have. And unfortunately, it only takes a few people create a severe imbalance in that system.
Thank you for the call. And Joshua Cooper Ramo, it sounds like somebody is thinking along your lines. And that whole idea of ethics keeps coming up again and again. And how much of it really is, you know, just human nature?
Well, I think, you know, I actually believe that if you give people the chance to do something disruptive and make a difference in the world, they're more likely to want to do something that's decent. I think when you structure a system so that it encourages greed, it's inevitable that you have a few greedy people who will do whatever it takes to make money. But my point is, and one of the arguments I make in the book is that our goal now as a government, as a nation, and even as we think of each other, and by the way, I think everything that's going on in the Midwest of the United States right now is a great example of this, is has got to be to empower as many individuals as possible and to give them a basic set of rights. And I don't think it's a particularly complicated set of rights. I mean, I think it's an income. It's an ability to have work that's meaningful. It's an ability to have health care, to raise their children, to engage in religious practice. And these are the kind of things that the United States traditionally has done very well and now needs to continue to do well. But I think the fundamental question she's raising is an important one, which is if you give humans the opportunity to kind of invent lives for themselves and to have an impact on the world around us, for them, are they likely to do something positive or negative? And I ultimately believe they're able to do something positive. The big challenge we face right now, to some degree, is just removing the fear. I think a lot of us are very fearful about the future. And, you know, anytime anybody's afraid, they act in ways that, you know, they're often not proud of. And I think the challenge now is, how do we have policies that really help remove the day-to-day fear in a lot of people's lives and that focus on the real issues they face, staying in their homes, having health care, being able to educate themselves and retrain themselves if they need to, being able to educate their children. It's not a complex set of things that we need to deliver, but it's a very important set of things to deliver, because, you know, pouring all this money into the financial economy and giving it to all these banks and, you know, bailing out insurance companies, you know, it's important to some degree to keep the infrastructure of the economy going, but at the end of the day, you really have to touch tens of millions of people's lives and try and give them the power to move forward with their lives. That's what's going to turn this economy around, not just fixing the banks.
Joshua Cooper Ramo is our guest this hour, the author of The Age of the Unthinkable. We'll be continuing our discussion after this break here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 15 minutes past 10 o'clock, or excuse me, 15 minutes before 11 o'clock. I'm Gene Purcell in for Kathleen Dunn today. Coming up after 11 o'clock, you can join Larry Mueller. He'll be talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with ideas about caring for your pet. That's up after 11 o'clock. This hour, it is the age of the unthinkable, why the new world disorder constantly surprises us and what we can do about it. Joshua Cooper Ramo is our guest, and he is the author of this relatively new book talking about the complexities of the modern world and how we fit into things. Let's get back to the calls right now. Joseph is with us from La Crosse. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you both gentlemen for all of this great conversation today. There's a comedian, Louis C.K., who recently said something that I just thought was really profound. He said, "The problem is everything is amazing today and no one is happy." And I thought he pretty much captured the situation fairly well. We really live in amazing times, and I think one of the things that we need to come to terms with and have always needed to come to terms with, and I know you guys were talking about the difference between now and years ago, but I don't think it's changed fundamentally. I don't think it was safe years ago. I don't think it's safe now. We talk about it's safe to fly. No, it's not. It's a giant mechanical bird in the air. It might fall down. It might have some problem. There's all kinds of problems, but I think we need to recognize the inherent instability in our situation and simply accept it. I think when we begin to experience the reality that we're in, not as permanently safe, not as something that won't go away, that's protected, but as something that we should simply enjoy for this moment, then we begin to take a look at it from a different perspective. One comment I had to make was the collapse of the Soviet Union. I heard a Japanese diplomat who I thought summed it up pretty well. He said it wasn't missiles that took down the Soviet Union. He said it was rock music and blue jeans.
Well, it could be. Joshua Cooper Ramo, your thoughts. I hadn't heard that part about everything is amazing right now and we're still not happy, but it does sort of get to what you're discussing.
Yeah, to some degree, although, again, it also highlights, I think, the other side. I mean, when I say it's the age of the unthinkable, it's not simply that the world is unthinkably terrifying. It's there's also unthinkable possibility. So I guess I might disagree with a little bit. I think it's amazing, and there are a lot of people who are actually very happy and excited, I hope. A possibility of invention that's all around us right now.
You know, I spent a lot of time in the book with people who are not only intent on using disruption to destroy the world order, but people who are intent on using disruption to make people's lives better, people like the people who started Google or who run some of the most progressive hospitals in the world or people doing bioengineering. I think that's the main point, is that the power each of us has to invent our lives today is greater than it's ever been before. That really is amazing. And the lesson of the age of the unthinkable is if you take the time to learn lessons from revolutionaries, there's a tremendous amount you can do to make a better future for yourself. And that really was the goal of this book, which is that if people sit down with this thing for a day or two, they will be able to get up and say, okay, I understand what's happening in the world, and here's some specific things I can do to make my life better.
And I wanted to return to another thing that you talked about in your book at length, I have to say, talking about small things making life better in a sense, but also here's another cliche, thinking outside of the box, and you use the example of the Wii, which is that, you know, that little toy that everybody's playing with these days.
Yeah.
And revolutionary, sort of, but it kind of gets back to your whole mashup concept where you take two things that are sort of unrelated, put them together, and you've got a new thing.
Exactly. And by the way, talk about, you know, amazing and happy. That's a great example of that. I mean, Shigeru Miyamoto, the guy who invented the Nintendo Wii, is this real genius of the video game business. He invented Super Mario Brothers and improved Donkey Kong and the Nintendo DS, which some of your listeners may know is a handheld device. It's very popular. But what he did with the Nintendo Wii was to essentially reinvent the video game business overnight by combining a traditional video game with the accelerometer system, which was used to fire airbags in a car. So it was a very unlikely combination of things, and frankly, his competitors thought he was crazy. But by mixing things together in that way, he was able to produce something totally spectacular and then overnight transformed the video game industry. And the point is that we can now do that with our own lives. Possible for you, and Gene, I don't know much about you, it's possible, sir, you can mash up your own life and be both a radio host and a scholar of 14th century French poetry.
How did you know?
Yeah, well, you know, it was your accent. Yeah. So, I mean, there's all of these moments of incredible possibility, both for our own lives and our children's lives, and it's just a matter of looking at the world and saying, you know, geez, all this stuff is terrifying us. If we really understand it, can actually be turned into the opportunity to not only make our lives better, but to actually do something even, you know, more important to some degree, which is to help make other people's lives better.
But, you know, you got to kind of get past a lot of folks getting past that initial terrified part, because that unsettled nature of having that little avalanche from that sand pile come down on top of you sort of makes people, I think, kind of want to bunker down in a sense.
Exactly. I mean, the main point of the book is that we have to find a way to live so that these moments where we're the most scared and the most terrified actually are the moments we are capable of innovating and learning and taking risks, because our traditional reactions are just the wrong ones. You know, if after 9/11, instead of, you know, having the reaction, we're just going to bomb these countries into oblivion, we said we're going to go build schools and hospitals and other things throughout the Middle East, and obviously do some military action, we'd be in a very different place today than we are. If when the subprime crisis hit, or when we saw people making exorbitant amounts of money on derivatives, which we knew had no underlying basis, and instead of our traditional reaction being, well, the market will take care of itself, we had a different reaction of saying, you know, this is unfair and dangerous, let's do something about it, we'd be in a much better position today. And so we really have to relearn our instincts. That those old instincts don't really serve us very well now, and that old instinct of saying things are unstable, I'm just going to hunker down, is the wrong instinct. It's got to be things are unstable, I'm going to go out and take advantage of it to do something amazing with my life and for my children's lives.
Let's go to Luke now, and Luke is with us from Milwaukee. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the author for hitting the nail on the head with a sledgehammer. Two shows ago this morning, he should have been on the air when they were talking about the piracy situation
in Somalia.
But there was a mention by, there was an article on Al Jazeera dealing with the reason for, behind the possible reason for the piracy. They were mentioning toxic waste and so forth. But very few news outlets seem to mention that and dissect it. In other words, people were trying to make this situation simple using old rules and seem to be ignoring this information.
Luke, thanks for the call. And what do you think about that? Is that piracy story, that, you know, the miraculous escape of the American captain and all that the last couple of days, has that been? Is that a good example of what you see as oversimplification?
Well,
more of the cases, I think, it's piracy has obviously been with us for a long time. It's a reminder of the kind of fundamental disorder and unpredictability that's lurking in the world system, and the reason that, you know, when you have something like a failed state, as you do in Somalia, that then leads very easily onto piracy, which then leads on to other things, and how difficult it is to prevent those sorts of things. And even though we have the most sophisticated, expensive military in the world, at the end of the day, it's very difficult to prevent those things. And, you know, this was a miraculous outcome, and I think for all of us whose thoughts and prayers were with the captain and his family, this turned out much better than anybody could have expected. But these situations are incredibly dynamic and chaotic, and learning how to operate in a chaotic world is very important. I actually think, if anything, that the rescue is kind of a reminder of the way in which the military, to some degree, once it begins to adapt, can adapt. That, you know, traditional approaches to that of having big battleships and destroyers was useless, but it was having these small Navy SEAL teams that ultimately produced a good outcome. So, you know, when our system is innovative, when the military is capable of being innovative, it is capable of assuring our security in very profound ways.
Are there other areas that you can look at in American society, for example, or the world society, where people are being innovative, where there is, you know, the future is already taking place?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the places where that's clearly happening every day, which I talk about in the book to some degree, is this area of kind of medical technology and the innovation that's going on in bioengineering. Anything kind of that's related to technology, internet is another example of this, is very much wired with this spirit of constant innovation. And then I think you're even starting to see, you know, again, particularly in your part of the world, which is an area that's been hit by kind of layoffs and real economic hardship, that there are kind of a few people who are saying, this is an opportunity to really do something creative and amazing with my life. And, you know, those are the examples to look at. The idea that the government can kind of protect you or save you or provide even a serious cushion for a long period of time, I think, has got to be retired. And people have got to take responsibility for their own lives now.
Yeah, at one point towards the end of your book, you lay out a very simple choice for all of us who are reading the book. You say it's imagination or crisis. You pick. And so is it that clear?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, there's this great line that, you know, the task of the imagination is to do the work of crisis, you know, basically to imagine what could happen and prepare yourself in advance. And I think that's where we are today. I think for a lot of people, it is a matter of sitting down, and you can either imagine a better future for yourself or you can face a crisis. And, you know, my sense is, if you take the time to sit and go through this book, you'll come away with a better sense of that, because it gives the kind of insight and sort of, here's what each of us can do to be imaginative about our future. You know, that guy said, you know, the world is clearly amazing right now. You have a choice between being amazing and unhappy and being amazing and happy. And I think if you see the people who are really making a difference in the world, it gives you an example of how it can be both amazing and happy.
Now, should people spend a lot of time, you know, because a lot of people tend to judge the future based on what's happened in the past. And, you know, I think a lot of the current models that you talk about are sort of trapped in that. But what can we learn from the past? I mean, there has to be something there.
Well, I think there are a few things. One is, I think you can learn that history does have this sort of cyclical nature of creation and destruction, and that the crisis is common in history after a period of time where you have a lot of change and the old models can't adjust. And so, you know, as we try to say, why is this moment significant beyond just a financial crisis, it is that we've arrived at a moment where you kind of have this sense that there's a global conversation going on now about what the future of the planet ought to look like. And those things are significant. And, you know, those conversations are usually conducted by armies at some point. And so I think we all need to be aware, and history teaches us that there's no such thing as kind of static in history. So I think that's one very important lesson. And the other lesson is the thing I sort of said earlier, which is, when you have these revolutionary moments, people and institutions and ideas emerge from obscurity to positions of great power. You know, if you and I were having this conversation 5 years from now, I'm sure 5 years from now there will be political figures, there will be internet sites, there will be sources of media, things that today we can't even imagine that will in fact be very influential. And so as people start looking around the world for things to pay attention to or what to do with their own lives, they need to understand this isn't just a moment of profound destruction, it's also a moment of real creation.
And, you know, there's this idealistic streak running through the book where, you know, you use the analogy of the pile of sand, and one little piece of sand can make a difference. You're saying the same thing about people, too, that one person really can make a difference in the scheme of things. And, you know, I think a lot of us don't think that anymore, that the machine is just too big and that we are just a small cog in it.
Yeah, which is a great irony. I think we all feel that way, and I think it's partly because we feel overwhelmed by the complexity. But the reality is, one person has more power to make a difference in the world now than ever before in history. And to some degree, that can be power to do bad things, as we saw what Osama bin Laden has done. On the other hand, it can be the power to do good things, as we saw, you know, millions of people one way or another getting involved in the presidential election last fall, or guys like Steve Jobs who reinvent the computer industry overnight. So I think we live at a time where individuals have more power than ever before, but our reaction to this complex world somehow is to feel powerless, but we're not powerless at all.
And there we are again, right, being sort of counterintuitive.
Yeah, exactly. It's a matter of, like I said, of kind of relearning those instincts. At the moment, you feel like you have the least power over your life. You might actually have the most.
Now, as you've finished the book, as you've had a chance to talk with people about it, people like me all over the country, all over the world, what's the reaction been to it? I mean, is it spreading the message that you were hoping it would?
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, you know, obviously to find out we made the New York Times bestseller list last week was hugely good news. And it's just a pleasure to go out and talk with people because I think we all feel anxious today. And it's nice to sort of have a book that explains sort of why we feel anxious, which is that the old models are failing. But that not only says that, but then says, look, here's a bunch of things you can do if you sit down and take the time. And, you know, it's an enjoyable book filled with lots of stories. And, you know, you can engage with this world. So it's worked out great. It's been very, very satisfying for me.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, Gene, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Joshua Cooper Ramo has been our guest this hour. He is the author of the new book. It's called The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. And it is published by Little Brown. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program 414E. Or you can always go online, head to our website at WPR.org and look at our program archives. We've got lots of programs there for you, and they are available for you 24 hours a day. Again, that's WPR.org. Carmen Jackson produced this hour, and we had on-air production from Rhonda Fanning. Thanks to her. Thanks to everyone who called. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.